introduce our main speaker, Jim B. from Santa Clarita.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Jim Breer, and I'm a real alcoholic. I'd like to thank the specific group for inviting me here, and the group, you guys all made me feel wonderful, and all the people in service here, this is awesome. What an awesome group you guys have here, and you should be very proud. I say I'm a real alcoholic. It's a little funny story to it. It was my first convention, and I probably had 5.5, 6 months, and I had taken the steps and thought I had a pretty good hold on things, you know, was on my ninth step in living 10, 11, and 12. And first time I ever heard chapter 3, long version, read at a meeting was at the Pacoima marathon meeting. And as they were reading it, they were going through the things, taking a trip, not taking a trip, switching from scotch to brandy. In my mind, I'm going to see brandy to heroin, heroin to cocaine, marijuana back to brandy. You know, I'm going through all these things. I'm going, yeah, I did that. Yeah, I did that. Yeah, I did that. And I looked at my buddy John. I go, what does that mean if you did them all? And this woman, Odessa, who was sitting in front of me, I know her now. She turns around. She goes, that means you're a real alcoholic. And I went, oh, Scott, I'm a real alcoholic. You know, and I've been identifying like that ever since. And it's funny that I find that in the book on page 21. And if you're new, you might want to read that because it says, what about the real alcoholic? Now, here's the guy that's been puzzling you. He seems normal in every way except when it comes to drink. Then he goes out and does incredible and tragic things. And, you know, that's kind of where the story starts, you know, on my first drink. You know, I was on a fishing trip with my father, and I'd go with my godfather. Now, my dad was, you know, he was a number one bantamweight in the world in the 40s, had fought for the world championship, fought Willie Pep 3 times. You know, and my godfather was this big piano mover from the docks in New Jersey, and he was a big street fighter. So going on these little fishing trips and hunting trips with them could be an odyssey, especially when we go into a bar on the way up or on the way back, and either someone was making my father upset, you know, they wanted to see if he still had it, you know, they'd recognize him. Or my godfather, he was a hot-headed Italian, and I mean, it didn't take much. And so it would start with one, and the other one would grab me and put me under the table and hand me my Roy Rogers, but today in AA I can say really it was a Shirley Temple, you know. But, you know, I'd sit there and I'd go like this and I'd watch this whole parade of people, bodies flying, and I'd go, oh my God, is this what it's going to be like to become a man? You know, and the thing that was killing me the most was that I could not tell my father that I was the big wussy in school. I was the one who was always getting picked on. I was the one who just failed the second grade because the bullies wouldn't let me do my work, and when I would bring in my homework to school, they would take it away, and I couldn't tell on them, you know, and this was the story of my life. I hated school, and so I'm on this one particular fishing trip, and it's 6 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, my dad and my godfather were both very heavy drinkers. I come from a long, long line of alcoholics, and, you know, they get the poles made up, and we get the poles thrown out, and now the tackle box comes a quart of blackberry brandy. And so my dad takes a drink, goes, ah, hands it to my godfather. My godfather takes a drink. Ah. And I go, what are you doing? And my godfather goes, well, it's cold. You know, we're drinking this so it keep us warm. I said, well, I'm cold. Give me some. You know, my father's going, oh, no, no, no. That's just for adults. It's always good to have an Italian godfather. Oh, Hank, come on, hell, he's shivering for Christ's sake. Give him a little snort. Oh, my dad's like, okay, just take a little bit. How do you take a little bit of blackberry brandy? I mean, you know, that stuff's like good, you know? I mean, you get that first thing, man, that goes down smooth, like ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. Hey, give me that, you know? And I drank like that the rest of my life, you know? You know, but I'm sitting there, you know, I got the pole, you know, and I used to love to go fishing. But now I'm sitting there, bored, and I'm not starting to muse, and now I'm already playing what's going to happen the rest of the day. We're going to pack up the car, we're going to hit the bar, the fight's going to start, they're going to put me under the table, but I'm going to run out, I'm going to run right to the pool table, I'm going to grab two pool balls, a pool stick, I'm going to hit the guy in the knee, and I'm going to throw the baseball or the pool ball, I'm going to hit him in the head, and I'm going to help. You know, I mean, I had this whole thing playing out in my head, and we're in the car, we're driving home, we go right by the bar, right by the other bar, now the other bar, now the other bar, and I'm going, damn, we ain't gonna stop. I was so bummed out. So bummed out. So the next day was Sunday, and I got to go to what was called the Boys Club back in those days. And that was a safe place for me because the counselors were always there. They didn't let anybody do anything, and it was always a safe place. And I had older friends that were at other schools that were tough, and they would protect me too, so I was safe there. But then I get home on Sunday night, and I knew Monday morning was coming. You know, and there was that terror. I don't know if anybody relates to that, but, you know, that was terror for me. You know, and so Monday morning came, and I thought, I just remembered, you know, how that feeling I had on that Saturday morning of how I was going to go out and help. And I thought, you know, my dad's got a refrigerator in the back full of beer. Maybe I'll just take a can of beer to school. You know, maybe that'll help me get over the nerves. And so I'm drinking this can of beer, and I'm walking to school, and I'm back in the second grade. You know, this is third grade stuff. You know, I'm drinking this can of beer, and I'm, you know, getting closer to school, and I'm getting down that block and a half away from the school, and I see that big hedge. Some of you guys might know what that big hedge is. That's the hedge that this kid has always hid behind, and he's jumped out and kicked my butt before school every Monday morning. And so this time I'm walking up, and I throw the beer can on the front yard in front of it, and sure enough, he comes out, and then bang, I hit him, and he goes, boom, and I'm going, oh my God. Oh my God. My God, it works. It works. It's the elixir of the gods. I can't believe this. I'm like, oh, what do I do? And I'm going, wait a minute. Now, I was always the last kid picked on a team. Anybody here ever have that? Were you the last kid? I mean, you get down to the end and go, oh, come on, Braird. I couldn't even say my name right. Yeah, come on, you're with us. Well, now, after this moment, I'm like, wait a minute. I'm now the baddest kid in school. Alcohol changed my life right there at that moment. That was it. Now I got a strut. I'm strutting to school. By nutrition time, everybody has found out what's happened. Now the girls are coming around. Now lunchtime comes when we're going to play. I'm the first kid picked. The next day, I'm the one picking first. I'm not a captain. I mean, everything just happened. I found out that I could run as fast as anybody, that I could hit left-handed or right-handed, that I could play baseball, that I could throw, I could play third base, and I could whip a ball to first. All these things happened to me from that first drink and having that little bit of confidence. And I remember that fear so well, but it was so funny that only a week or two later, I forgot all about that fear. And I never got back to that until I did a four-step. Did I ever relate to that? From that moment on, I was never afraid of anything again. And I would defy anyone and do anything to prove that I was not afraid. And that was the way I lived, you know, the next 34 years of my life was like that. And, you know, went through some pretty tough times. My father, who I had adored and wanted to be like, at the age of 12, became this mean, disgusting drunk from this happy-go-lucky, fun-loving drunk. The progression of the disease had progressed to that stage for him. And now I couldn't stand going home. I couldn't stand what he was doing. And my sister was 10 years older than I am. And of course, back then, and this is in the 60s, marijuana was just coming available, and Red Devils, and little cross tops, and you know, little things like that. You know, Vietnam had just started, and so it was normal for me to, like, I didn't want to be like my dad anymore. You know, so we started smoking weed, and we started taking pills, and I went right into it. You know, right into it, and I was burglarizing houses right away, and to buy drugs, and my cousin caught me coming out of a house with some stuff, and he made me get in the car. First, he made me go back into the house and put it back. And then he made me get in the car. And after he yelled at me for about 20 minutes, he took me over to my brother-in-law's house and said, what do we do with this kid? He's robbing everybody. And they came up to the deal. They weren't going to stop me. They knew they couldn't stop me from doing drugs and smoking weed and drinking. And I didn't know this at the time, but they were both big dealers. And so they taught me how to sell it so I didn't have to steal and let everybody else steal. And then that was my first entrepreneurship. So at 12 years old, by the time I'm 14, I'm supplying all the schools. And we're talking about in L.A. So we're talking about a lot of high schools and junior high schools, and I'm making a lot of money, enough that I could buy my own Cadillac at 14 years old, two-year-old Coupe de Ville. I left home at 14, got my own apartment. And of course, I went to school because that's where I made a living. And, you know, I mean, and that's just the way it was. And everybody would be at my house after school, and we'd be drinking, and we'd be getting loaded and having girls, and just, and actually life was pretty cool at that time. You know, I wasn't one that had to go out and be in the street like I know a lot of kids were. You know, what helped me a lot was that I had been in martial arts from the age of 10. So by the time I was 14, I had 4 years in the Kung Fu and Tai Chi, and then I was boxing, and coming from a long line of you know, fighters, you know, it was natural for me. I didn't feel like I had to worry about it. You know, and because my dad was taking me hunting and stuff, I was very proficient with guns. And so the natural progression of where I was, that by the time I was 17, 18 years old, I had become a big smuggler. And that was a hard thing to break. You know, it's funny how I got away with it for all those years, but as soon as I turned 18, it was like the police were waiting for me. I found out later they knew they couldn't do nothing to me as a minor, and they waited till I was an adult so they could get me, you know. And it didn't take long. They arrested me like 29 times for felonies, and I was able to get out of it with attorneys and everything, but it was a hell of a life. And about 2 years of going through all that stuff, I had sat in front of my dad's house on the last time. I had luckily won a court case. They had set up a whole fraudulent case against me, and their eyewitness didn't ID me, and I ended up getting off. And I'm sitting in front of my dad's house because the attorneys took everything I owned. I mean, everything. And I had a lot. I had clothes, I had jewelry, I had furniture, paintings, statues, 4 or 5 cars. You know, I mean, I had a lot. And I had to give them everything. I was able to keep $5, and I was able to keep the one car that had the hottest license plate in California because they didn't want it. And that was what I got to keep. A pair of 501 jeans, a pair of Keds, and a Pencraft t-shirt. White. I didn't even get a colored t-shirt. And they took everything. But I got off. And I'm sitting in front of my dad's house in that car, and I'm watching him bouncing off the walls. And here he's got this house, this apartment building, boats, and all these things. And he is drunk every day. And I realized, you know what? Maybe he had it right all along. And so, you know, a year before, I had managed to get 30 days in the studios as a technician because of my dad, and I was able to step into that career. And so I just did that. I stopped doing what I was doing, and I went to work in the studios, and, you know, it was the summertime, and I had to wear t-shirts because I had tracks all up and down my arms. So I had to wear long sleeve shirts in 110 degrees weather just so, you know, till my arms healed. And that's what I did. And I'd go to the bar and I'd drink every night. And it didn't take me long. I mean, from the age of 19 until I was about 22, I had 7 502s. And I was still going to jail. And that's where I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, was through the court system. And back in California in those days, Alcoholics Anonymous was actually in the courtroom. And you'd have this meeting with your lawyer and the DA, and then they would and the judge would send you over to the AA desk, and then they would take you out and they'd interview you to see if, you know, you were worth taking a shot at, and if you were, then the judge would go ahead and sign you up for meetings. You know, the first couple I had 25 meetings, the next couple I had 50, the next couple I had 100, next couple I had 250, and then the last one was 500 meetings. And again, that same lawyer who had gotten me out of all the other stuff was the one who was getting me out of all of these. And I went to a lot of meetings, and I never once had any inkling of ever becoming a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I can remember them 12-stepping me in these meetings, and they'd say, well, do you drink? And I'm going, well, yeah, I drink a lot. And I shoot a lot of dope, and I smoke a lot of weed, and I take a lot of pills. don't I belong here? Well, no, you got to go over here for that. You got to go over here for that. And I'm like, I don't even know if I want to be here. I mean, I got to go here and here. Just sign my court card. I went through that. And this was like 1972, 73, and it was a lot different than it is today. You know, today this is awesome. There are things that I love about the way Alcoholics Anonymous has always been, and I'm one of those old-fashioned AA people. I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I like it straight up. You know, but I'm glad that I was able to come this time and be part of this. You know, I'd go to these meetings, and I was drinking pretty heavy, and back then, I mean, they made me thirsty. I mean, I'd sit in these meetings, man, and I mean, I'd have to have a joint in the ashtray just to get me to the bar. You know, because, I mean, I would just get, I mean, these drunkologs would go on and on. And I mean, you know, it was worse than N.A. because N.A. is, I mean, you can't even listen to that for 55 minutes, you know, without wanting to go stick a needle in your arm, you know. I mean, they get to the end of the meeting and it would be, okay, and yeah, my life is great and you know, and everything is wonderful now. And thank you for letting me share, you know. I mean, you know, and so early on when my sobriety, I got to go and speak at some of those meetings, but, you know, it was making me nuts. It was making me nuts. And I just didn't feel part of this, you know. And I'd look on the steps on the wall, and those steps were always on the wall. And I could say, yeah, okay, you know I got a drinking problem. You know, I know if I stopped drinking, my life would be manageable. So I never really had that clarity of that step. I knew there was a God out there. I had been an altar boy even younger, you know. So, I mean, I knew there was a God. I knew I was damned. I mean, you know, when I was six, they were telling me, you know, if you have sex out of marriage, well, I was molested, so I was going to hell. If you read your father's Playboys, you were going to hell. If you drank, if you did this, if you did that, so I knew I was going. And now by the time I'm 17 and I'm running borders and I got guns and I'm doing this and doing that, I'm already burning. You know, so it was all about getting all I could get before I go. And now I'm, you know, going to these meetings and I get to that third step and it would say, turn your will and your life over the power of God. To the care of God as you understand him. And man, I understand him as this guy who's going to scorch me and send me right down, you know, and I ain't turning my will over to him. There's just no damn way. I'm really glad this all works for you. I mean, I really am. I'm grateful it all works for you. But my case is different. And that kept me out of the rooms for 24 years. That defiance. You know, and I ended up in this meeting. I was working at CBS, and it was on Radford. And this actor that was sober told me about this meeting across the street on Radford, and it was a group called Radford. And he said, it's really cool, man. Why don't you come over? You might like it. And I still needed about 30 signatures, and I said, okay, why not? So I went over to this meeting, you know, and I'm sitting there, and the meeting was kind of cool, you know, and I'm laughing, and there was this guy, I'll never forget this guy, he had like one or two teeth, and he sit there and go, if you want what we have. And I sit there and go, well, see, I got a grand in my pocket, and I got a new car out there, and I got two girls waiting for me at the bar. Pal, I think you want what I have. You know, you don't even have any teeth. You know, and today I know that guy's name was Larry Tuttle, and he was one of the great members of AA, and today I would give everything I own to have what he had. You know, but back then I had no clue. I was so arrogant that I just could not listen or hear, you know, and so I put my card in the basket, but he did make me laugh, and I felt comfortable in this room for the first time, and I get my court card back, and it's not signed, and so I said, wait a minute, how come he didn't sign my card? He goes, we don't sign court cards here. I went, you got to be kidding me, man, this is the first time I've ever felt comfortable in a meeting, and you don't sign court cards, and this little voice out of the back room says, honey, if you keep coming back, I'll sign your court card. And her name was Alabama. And she never sat down and hard-stepped me at all. She was really cool. But what she would do is she'd come up and give me these little zingers. Like, hey, Jim, you know, if you quit drinking, you'd stop going to jail. Keep coming back. You know what I'm saying? Hey, Jim, you know, if you quit drinking, your life would change. Keep coming back. You know, so she kept giving me these little zingers, you know, and I never forgot that. I don't remember much of anything in those meetings, but I remember her, and I remember those things, and I'm indebted to her because when it came time for me to actually come here, she was the spirit that helped me get here. And, You know, I tried to get sober. I knew at that time I could not do AA, though. You know, so I'd get in these drunks, and I'd get in these crying jags, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, an hour after your last drink, and you realized you forgot to go to the store and buy some. So now you're out of booze, and an hour later you're like, and you're watching those old black and white movies, and, you know, you hear this commercial come on. Do you have a drinking problem? Call Schick. We have an answer for you. Well, I found that it was just like this electric shock therapy and things were rubber bands. I'm like, not for me. But then there was this other commercial that said, alcoholism, we have an answer. Come to Raleigh Hills. And so I thought, well, Raleigh Hills is kind of cool, you know? Maybe I'll call Raleigh Hills. It had a nice sounding name to it. Not like Schick, you know, a razor blade company, you know. So I called up Raleigh Hills. They said, yeah, I got a drinking problem. What kind of program you got? And they said, well, we have a program by where we make you drink as much as you can so that you can't stand a drink anymore. And you can't stand the smell of it so that when you smell it, you'll throw up. I went, so you drink all you can drink? And she said, oh, yeah. I said, sign me up. Yeah, I'll be there. I'll be there at 9 o'clock in the morning, you know. You know, so I go there, and I'm just hammered out of my mind, right? And I'm, you know, I'm all ready to sign the papers. Man, they got me all excited. I'm gonna be drinking, and then I'm not gonna drink. This is gonna be great. And then they asked me for that great check for $10,000. I'm like, what? My insurance won't pay for this? No, we found out Motion Picture doesn't pay for alcoholism. And I'm like, oh shoot. There goes my chance to get well. And they called my mom, and my mom, everything. And I told them, my mom's not going to help me. What do you mean? Every time I've asked her for anything, it's always been no. So she's just going to say no again. And I'll be doggone. They called, and she said yes. And so there I was going to Raleigh Hills. Now, if you've never been to this or never heard about this program, this is a really hoot. Because, you know, you go in that, and that night they put you in this nice bed, and they hook you up to an IV, and they give you a Valium to calm your nerves, you know. And then the next morning they come in and they give you a shot each side of your cheek, and then they put this robe over you, and you go into this room, and there's this, like, you know, kitchen full of every kind of booze you can think of in big bottles. And she goes, what do you like to drink? I said, well, what do you got? She goes, we got everything. I said, I can have anything? So I'm thinking, what do I like that's expensive? You got Crown Royal? Oh, yeah, we got Crown Royal. She said, but you're going to be drinking really big glasses of it. And Crown Royal can be a little rough. You sure you want Crown Royal? And I'm thinking, well, I'm going to drink it straight in big glasses. I guess vodka. I can always drink a lot of vodka. So you got any Russian vodka? Oh, yeah, we got Russian vodka. I don't know if it was Smirnoff or Popoff, but it was Russian back in those days. So they're filling up this big goblet, you know, and they hand it to me, and I'm going, really? Okay, and, you know, and it takes the first couple sips are always a little rough, but, you know, you get your momentum down, you know. It turns into water, you know. So I get down to the last one, and she's already bloop, 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 pouring the next one. I'm like, man, this is cool. Here you go. And I'm like, really? Okay. And drink it down and then another one. Here you go. And you did this until you were damn near dead. And then the goons would come in and they'd grab you on each arm and they'd drag you to the bed. And then the next morning it would start all over. And they did this for 10 straight days. And when you were done, believe me, you just smelled booze, you threw up. And I'm doing this show called The Greatest American Hero. Some of you might have remembered this show. And I was the dolly grip. Now, my cousin and my father did not quit drinking, and the three of us are working together on this show. So they're always hungover. So I'd have the camera all set up, and I'm working hard, you know, sweating, you know, because, you know, I'm like, you know, 3-4 weeks sober now, and, you know, I mean, I'm doing good, and they come up, and they're eating the sandwich, and, man, you can just smell last night's booze coming out of them. And I just had my breakfast burrito that I got off the caterer, right? Man, I'm throwing up in the butt can, and the director's going, what the hell, is he drunk again? You know, because he never got sick before, man. God, how bad is he? And my dad goes, no, he's sober. I mean, I was always a little drunk, you know, but I was never throwing up anywhere. I wasn't really a puker, you know. And so I got 6 months of sobriety out of that. And I was doing another movie in Mississippi, and I was actually working for my idol, George C. Scott. And I came up with an idea. We were doing a baseball movie. We could not get the stands filled with people. And they'd offered him money, but that didn't bring him out. And I said, well, gee, man, I mean, why don't we just offer them free beer, hot dogs, all the food they could eat, that kind of food, and give them 20, 30 bucks, and we'll fill the stands. And sure enough, we did. I didn't know that the money man in L.A. was a newly recovering alcoholic and didn't appreciate us giving everybody free beer, and fired him as the director for that idea. And I was so angry because it was my idea. I immediately got to the hotel. I walked right up to the bar, and the bartender knew to pour me a Perrier because that's what I had had every night for the first, you know, last 4 weeks. And I just whacked that glass right off the bar. I said, give me a double shot of Jack Daniels and a beer. And I drank that shot straight down. I chug-a-lugged that beer, and I went to my room. Now, the next morning was the interesting thing, because I thought, wow, you only had one drink. Now, really, what, was it a double and a beer? So it's really three, but to me, that was one drink. And so the experiment went so well, I'm thinking, hey, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. Maybe Raleigh Hills really cured me. You know, so I had a beer at lunch, a couple beers after work, and that first week went really well. Really well. So well that Sunday we thought we'd just go ahead on down to New Orleans and go check out the French Quarter. And they have a thing called Hurricanes. And they only let you drink two. Not me. I'll go to four different bars and have two. So I had eight, you know. And I'm drunk as a skunk, and I'm driving, and this car pulls up, and this guy was so big, he was bigger than the refrigerator. You remember William Perry, the lineman for the Chicago Bears? This guy was huge. I mean, he was coming out of the car, sitting there, and he cuts me off. And, of course, I tell him to go screw himself. And he gets out of the car and flashes this badge, and I'm like, I didn't know they let people like you be cops. So now I'm in trouble, but thank God the girl that I had been dating in Mississippi, who had happened to be with me, was the head of the probation department of Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And she said, no, no, he's with me, and we're going home. And he says, you're very lucky. I said, thank you, sir, you know. And so we went back, and we went home, and then I came back home, and boy, it was only about another 2-3 months, and I was back at Raleigh Hills trying the same thing, expecting a different result. And I put myself through it again. This time I paid the $10,000. All the money I came home from with on that show, I just put it down. I figured, you know what, if I could get sober, I could get another job. And I got 90 days the second time. And, you know, I'm out with a buddy of mine, and we used to love to play golf. And this guy was a scratch golfer, and we'd go out with people, and you know, we both drank a lot, so they always thought they could sucker him into betting. And of course, he did this on purpose, and he would take all their money. So we would go to Brookside Winery, and we'd get 6-7 bottles of wine and take it out on the golf course, you know, just for a little teaser till the evening came. And this one day, I pull up in the driveway, and I just got out of the car, and again, I'm not really a puker, except for when I want to drink more. And I got out of the car, and I threw up all this red wine. I'm like, oh, Leo, man, we should have never bought that red wine. We should stick to white wine on the golf course. And thank God Leo knew that we were drinking white wine. And that was blood. That wasn't red wine. He immediately threw me in the car and rushed me to what was the care unit at North Hollywood Medical Center, where I can remember being in the operating room with, or whatever that room is they bring you in, and the doctors yelling at me and yelling at each other. They were trying to stop the bleeding inside of me because I was bleeding from a lot of different organs. And basically, I was drowning in my own blood. And that's what alcohol will do to you, you know? And so the doctor's telling me that, you know, you need to go to AA. And I said, AA won't work for me. You don't understand. I can't go there. He said, well, you got to do something, because if you take one more drink and your stomach starts to bleed again, you're done. I said, do you mean I've drank all I could drink? I mean, that was the important question to me. You know, the doctor needed to tell me that I had drank all I could ever drink. And he said, yeah. I said, well, can I smoke marijuana? He said, you know, that's funny you say that. Since you won't go to AA, I'll settle for that. He said, you know what? He goes, at UCLA, they are using that to help with ulcers, so it might help. He said, but you got to get at least a year or two from a drink. You got to let your stomach heal. You got to let these organs heal. So I went ahead and I went on a marijuana maintenance program. And after the first year, I felt pretty good. I mean, I was nuts. I didn't know people thought I was a bragger and a show-off and arrogant and all these other things, you know. I just thought I was having a good time, and I was very good at what I did at work, and they had me there because I was the only one of the persons that could do what I did, you know. And then about 6 months later, I had this little boy, he's a big kid now, he's an adult, 28 years sober, Josh, became my son, and I married his mom, and Joshua came in, and I got my second year of sobriety, and I felt real good, and I knew if I drank, I'd lose all that. And so I just didn't drink for 12 and a half years. And I built a bright future and became wealthy and all of those wonderful things that can come to you when you're not drinking, except like the book says, and I'm grateful again for page 21 and 22, because it says that I can build a bright future for myself and then pull it down upon my head, and that's exactly what I did. And I had become so impossible to be around that the wife left, the kids left, and I didn't have to drink to do it. And so it only took about another 2 years that I took the kids to Florida, to Orlando, Florida, to Disney World. It was funny, because this divorce was kind of tough. And I said to the kids, and my daughter's not here, but Joshua's here, and I said, guys, I go, look, you know, this has been really tough on you, so why don't we take a little couple of day vacation, you know, and I'll take you somewhere. Where would you like to go? Now, in my mind, I'm thinking, hey, 2 days at Disneyland would be cool, right? You know, one, 2 nights at the Disneyland Hotel, a couple, you know, maybe we'll go over to Knott's Berry Farm. But both of them, I mean, didn't even take a second. Disney World, Daddy! And I went, Disney World? Yeah, Florida, Disney World! And I'm like, oh, I told them anywhere. And I've always had this thing about being a man of my word, so we went to Disney World for 10 days. And we went and saw everything, and it was just an awesome, awesome, awesome trip. And on the very last night, our knight wins the contest. And he rides up on his horse. And he gets up to us, to all of us in the stands of the area, and he takes the rose and he throws the rose, and my little girl catches it and goes like that, and my heart breaks. And at that moment, and I know this for a fact to be a divine happening, a divine thing, an act of providence, as it says in the 12 and 12, that this waitress sat down 2 glasses of sangria instead of the 2 root beers that I had ordered. And I said, ma'am, I ordered root beer, not wine. Please. And she said, I'll be right back. I'll bring you a root beer. And left the 2 glasses instead of taking them. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm very angry that this is the last night I'm going to be a full-time father. And so I'm musing about South America and the sangria and the pictures, you know, in between our little runs. We'd get some time in the beaches there, and we'd have these big pictures of sangria full of fruit, and I remembered all those wonderful days, and I went, you know what, Jim, you haven't had a drink for 12 and a half years. Maybe you're not an alcoholic. Boom, I drank it. And then I conveniently looked up at the ceiling, and I said, all right, you bitch, now you've taken my sobriety too, and I blamed it all on her. I had nothing to do with it. I didn't pick up the glass. It was her that made me do it, just like everything in my whole life had been. And so the next best thing to do was to drink the second one. And so I drank the next one. And that was it. I went back to the hotel room, same scenario. I woke up the next morning, hey, you only had 2. I guess maybe you're not an alcoholic. So we're on the plane flying home that morning, and kids fall asleep. And back in those days, those little carts had little bottles, but they were glass. And they made these nice little ching, ching, ching sounds as the little carts would go down the aisle. And I'm sitting there listening to those little bottles jingle, you know, and I'm like, ah, what the hell, they're sleeping. Well, you know, just, I mean, I'm already salivating, I'm sweating, you know, I'm like, oh. And she gets to me and I'm going, hi, do you have any Smirnoff? And she goes, yeah. I said, do you have the blue label? That's the 100 proof, if, in case you didn't know. And she says, yeah. I said, let me have one of those with 7-Up. Yeah, 7-Up would be all right. Well, make it two. Make it a double. And so, you know, I had that first drink, and it kind of calmed my nerves because I'm very upset. I know she's going to be at the airport, and, I mean, I'm not even going to get to the car with the kids. They're going to go just like that, and that's going to be it for 2 weeks, and I won't even see them. You know, so then the cart comes back down. It's a long flight from Florida. And so I get another one, and the flight cart's coming back, and I get another one. And so I had three, and I was feeling a little bit, and I was drinking vodka because I didn't think she could smell it, you know. So, you know, vodka doesn't smell, right? And so I wouldn't want her to think I was drinking, you know. And I wouldn't want anybody to know that I had taken my first drink. Now I'm starting to think like that. That alcoholic thinking is already starting to play. So, of course, she takes the kids. And then I get my suitcases and I go out, and there's my buddy with my car. And I get in the car and we're taking off. And I said, hey, pull over to this liquor store. I want to get a pack of cigarettes. He goes, you haven't smoked in 7 years. I go, yeah, I'm really upset. I need a cigarette. He goes, well, have one of mine. I go, I don't want one of those faggy menthols. I want a Marlboro, man. Pull the car over. He goes, but Jim, I go, it's my car. Pull it over. He goes, okay, man, no problem. He pulls the car over, and I'm going to go get one pack of cigarettes. I'm going to smoke two or three, then I'm going to throw the pack away, okay? He goes, okay, man. So I go into the liquor store, and, of course, I come out with two bottles of Absolut, a carton of Marlboro, a bottle of 7-Up, and a bag of ice that I have no idea how I'm going to get all the way to Santa Clarita with a bag of ice in 100-something degree weather. You know, and it was on, you know. Pure alcoholic, you know. It don't matter how much drugs you do, man. I mean, I was either doing drugs to drink more or to not drink my whole life. That's what my whole life was about. You know, alcohol has always been that thing. It allowed me to, I could always be a nuclear physicist. I could be a stuntman. I could be a professional fighter. I could be a fighter pilot. I could be, a hitman. I could be anything I wanted to be with a few drinks. You know, nothing else would ever give that to me. You know, and there it was again, man, and I was alive. And after that weekend of getting hammered, I decided, you know what, if I do this tomorrow, I'll be an alcoholic. And so I waited 3 weeks. Didn't have a drink. 3 weeks later, boy, I was at on the set, and it was Friday, man, and I just couldn't wait. And I made sure no one would really know, so I went out of town to drink. Got a hotel room, went down to San Diego, down to the Islandia Hotel where I used to run away to, and I drink for 2 days, and I try to make it back Sunday night. Sometimes I'd make it back Monday, be late to work, but I'd be there hungover, you know, and then I'd go another 3 weeks, and then it was every 2 weeks, and then it was every weekend, then it was every day. You know, and that's just the progression of how it went for me, you know. I can remember there was this woman I really, really fell in love with without even really being with her. I mean, just being around her and stuff. So my friend was hooking me up with her, and we were gonna go, and I was going to meet her at this horse riding stable. And I had never been on a horse, and this was in between my first two trips to Raleigh Hills. And, you know, here I'd been to how many meetings? I mean, I've been to hundreds of meetings. You think I would have heard anything? So they give me this horse, and I get on the horse, and they're all riding off. And I'm trying to impress this girl. I've never been on a horse, you know. So I'm kicking them and saying, come on. You know, the horse ain't moving. So the guy's laughing. He comes up. He hands me the whip. He says, just show her the whip. Okay, so I showed her the whip. I went like this, and Jesus, she turned into Trigger, you know. Now, I'm trying to impress this girl, so I am not going to fall off of this horse. I mean, I got the death grip on, you know. And this horse, and off we go, man. And this horse is taking me through the trees, through the bushes, through the rocks. I mean, I'm getting cut up and stuff. I'm in shorts and a T-shirt. I got scratch and bleeding down my arm, and I got this horse's head pulled all the way over here, and I'm going, whoa! And he won't whoa. You know, and all of a sudden he ducks his head in this tree branch, goes boom, hits me right on the head, and bang, I go all the way back to the horse's ass, and I come right back up, and I didn't fall off. And then I got a little trickle of blood coming, and now I'm mad as hell. So I'm whipping this horse all the way up the top of the mountain, turns in the trigger, and now the horse is coming back down the mountain, and it's taking me right back for that tree branch. I got your number. And so when we get to that tree branch and the horse goes to duck his head, I yanked his head up and his head hit the tree branch and snapped that thing right off. Unfortunately, now the horse is mad. I mean, he's just tearing me through everything. We get back to the stable. Now, my friends that were supposed to go on this wonderful, joyful ride only got about 100 yards, and they're still on the ground laughing. They can't even ride the horse. Watching me make an absolute fool out of myself. Now, you'd think out of hundreds of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have ever heard the term, let go and let God. No. What is that defiance that's in an alcoholic? What is that about us that we will do anything to prove that we are not afraid, that we are not alcoholic? The persistence of our illusion is astonishing to everybody else but us. And, I mean, and that's just that's my story, you know. That was the way my whole life was. You know, so now we're back, and I had my two trips to the care unit, and now I've drank again. I've come back from Florida. And the studios now had a thing called, you had a one-time shot to rehab. And so I was doing a show called The Naked Truth. It was the first season, and we only got about 4 episodes in it. And my friend was here in Vegas, and he had won his first rodeo, and it happened to be the granddaddy. He had the big buckle. I mean, he was so proud of himself. And he got back to the set late, and he was showing everything off, and he's drunk as a skunk. And they didn't fire him. They just sent him home, and he didn't make it home. That's the other part of alcoholism. He went off the bridge, off the off-ramp, and went into the cement part of the bridge, and the car just went to pieces, and he was killed instantly. And I went on a drunk of all drunks, and you know, I ended up drinking myself into such a state that it was incredible. And I drank about 5 quarts of booze and a case of beer and trying to drink myself to death. And I don't know how this act of providence happened 18 months later from the time that I would come back from Florida. But I found myself sitting at this intake in the valley about 8 hours after my last drink. I don't know how I had the head of the union on the phone at 3 o'clock in the morning, but I found him. I don't know how. And I ended up in this rehab, and they made me go to this hospital. And as I was checking into the hospital, I remember just kind of taking a break. You know how you just kind of go, okay, now where were we? And there was a woman in front of me, now there's a man. And he's going, what do you mean, where were you? You died, you asshole. And I went, what? I only drank. And all of a sudden, I could feel the cold seat on my bare butt. And I look down, and I'm in a wheelchair, and my clothes are gone. I got tubes coming out of me. He goes, yeah, you died right there on the floor. Another act of providence. I had that massive seizure. I happened to be at the hospital, you know, and they were able to bring me back. And if they didn't, I wouldn't be standing here. And even then, I still would not go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd go to rehab. I just wanted to stop drinking. I was still going to smoke weed. I was not going to come and do these steps and turn my will or any of that stuff. And I'm grateful for that time in that rehab. I remember my counselor, he goes, Jim, you've been to hundreds of meetings. You've heard all this stuff. He goes, why don't you take the book and go to your room at night and start reading the stories? He said, and see if there's not something that one of these men or women had that you might want bad enough that you would give this program a chance. And I came across this one story where a guy was talking about he had peace of mind. And I started thinking about peace of mind. What is peace of mind? I mean, I smoked opium from Vietnam and been sitting against a wall and not being able to move, and my head was still going like that. I mean, I couldn't move, but my head was still running. So I'm sitting there with no concept of a quiet mind at all, ever in my life. And so I got up out of bed, and I ran down to the room where he was working, and I banged on the door, and I go, Keith, Keith. He goes, what? I go, what's that? He goes, what? I go, that right there. What's that? He goes, peace of mind? I'm going, yeah, what is that? He said, that's when your mind gets quiet and everything's at peace. And I went, really? Can I have that? He said, yeah, you take the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and you give this program away, you can have that. I said, okay, I'm willing to go to any length to feel what that feels like. I don't know what it's, if I'll like it, but I want to feel it first. And I kind of made my first little commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous. A couple of days later, I was sitting in the room where we do our treatment things, and I was reading the steps, and I was mad at God. You know, I'd grown up with Father Knows Best and my three sons, and, you know, how come I grew up in this alcoholic home of chaos and yelling and screaming, and how come I couldn't have had that kind of life? And now because I'm mad as hell, why can't I give that kind of life to my own children? And I started reading the steps, and I read the first step, and I'm saying, okay. Now, the thing they also had me do is write my life story. And when I read it, the counselor goes, okay, Jim, I know you think your life's manageable, but after hearing what you just read, don't you think you ought to think that your life's unmanageable? It was for the first time I had no comeback. So I had that in my mind as I was looking at that first step, and I went, okay, yeah, I know I'm an alcoholic, I'm powerless, and my life's unmanageable, and I know there's a God. I still know he won't do anything for me. And I got to that third step. I said, okay, so let's say I do that. The fourth step didn't scare me so much. Once I had accepted the fact that I was going to do step three, the fourth step didn't bother me. You know, and I looked at those other steps, and I remember what people had shared for the first time. And I said, okay, I'm going to give this thing a shot. I never tried Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. I'm going to give it 1 year and see what happens. And if I don't like it after a year, then I'll do something else. And then I got out of rehab, and I was at a meeting, and an old-timer named Larry Ziner, and he was sharing from the podium. It was my first meeting at the rafters, and he was scaring the living bejesus out of me. And I would never ask this guy to sponsor me. I mean, he was just too scary. But I had to go ask him what was the secret to long-term sobriety. So I went up and said, Larry, I got a question. He goes, yeah, kid, what's your question? And he made me feel good right off the bat because I was 40 years old and I hadn't been called a kid in a long time, you know, so that was kind of cool, you know. So he buttered me up a little first. And he said, what's your question? I said, what is the secret to long-term sobriety? He goes, kid, you just make a lifetime commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous and then just live life one day at a time. And I went, really, that's all there is to it? He goes, that's all there is to it. So I ran to my buddy John, who I'd gotten sober with. And I said, John, I found the secret. He goes, what's that? I go, Larry told me all we got to do is make a lifetime commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous, and then we just got to live life one day at a time. You know how newcomers talk. Blah, 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 you know. And so John and I got on our knees, and we prayed for that right there on the spot. And it's funny, we're both still here. And we're both of service, and we love Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I've heard people come up to me and say, well, that's not in the book. Well, yeah, it is. It says there are those who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. So that's kind of a commitment, don't you think? If you're going to completely give yourself, it's kind of like making a commitment. So he just used a different word for me to understand. And it was something I hadn't heard repetitiously. So it made sense to me. You know, that no matter what happened in my life, I would always be there for AA, whatever they needed. If they needed help, if the floors needed swept, if the coffee cups needed washing, if I had to stay and help somebody that was new until wee hours of the morning and sleep an hour and go to work, whatever it was, I was to do that. And the gift for doing that was that I got to stay. And that's what I've done. Immediately got into H&I. And John and I were doing H&I. We were doing three panels a week. We were going to Warm Springs every Wednesday night. We'd do the Warm Springs Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. As we were walking out, they'd come and tell us, hey, NA hasn't showed up. We were at the same time, so I would run over and start the NA meeting while John ran the AA meeting, and halfway through, we'd switch. And then we'd be walking out, and they'd come and say, see, he didn't show up. Can you do a CA meeting, too? Well, yeah, and we'd go in and do the CA meeting. So we'd get there at 6 o'clock, and we'd leave there at, like, 10:30 at night, you know, and we did that every Wednesday night for, like, 3 years. And I kept the one Wednesday night. I kept the first Wednesday, and it's going on 12 years now that I've had that panel, you know, and I got to do a lot of other things, you know, secretary meetings or be part of conventions or be part of committees. You know, I was blessed to have chaired the last year's Santa Clarita Convention. Alcoholics Anonymous has done everything for me. You know, I don't know what it is about what this program did, except for it put words to the way I felt. I never could describe how I was feeling, and I never knew I could say it. I mean, a funny thing was, like, I was sitting in this meeting, and this guy was talking about how he got angry, and he just had the thought. He wanted to rip the guy's head off, you know, he wanted to pee down his neck and do all this crazy stuff that's all running around his mind. And I'm thinking, I thought I was the only one that thought like that. And he's sharing that. I got to go talk to him, you know. So after the meeting, I went up. I said, wow, I think like that too. He goes, dude, we all do. I went, what? We all have those crazy thoughts. We all go into wild things. I'm going, really? Wow. You know, I never could tell anybody that. Because he shared it from a podium. I was able to go up to him and say, the two most important words you're going to hear tonight, me too. That's what this whole thing is about. It's about me too. It's about coming to the grips of alcoholism. And yeah, I think I might have this disease too. Wow, you did that? I did that too. Maybe you can help me. You know, if you're new, that's what we do here. One drunk talking to another. You know, and sponsorship is a wonderful thing and a wonderful blessing. And being able to go through the steps and then take people through the steps has been a wonderful gift. I mean, it's been a wonderful gift. You know, there's a great paragraph in the 12 and 12, in the 12th step on page 110, where it says, practically every AA member will declare that no satisfaction has been deeper and no joy greater than a 12-step job well done. To watch the eyes of men and women open with wonder as they move from darkness into light. To see whole families reassembled. To watch them receive back into their community in full citizenship. And above all, to watch them awaken to the presence of a loving God in their lives. These are the things that we receive as we carry this message to the next alcoholic. I mean, what a wonderful thought. You know, I've been able to have some great success in Alcoholics Anonymous. I always wanted to breed and race a horse that would be known, you know, and I got to do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we were up for champion, and all of a sudden they wrote stories about me, and I promised my kids when they were born, because they were mad that I was doing this stuff, and their mom didn't like it, I said, don't worry, kids, one day they're going to write a story about me. And that was 26 years ago I told them that that would happen, but it wasn't until I had 4 or 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous that it did happen. You can do anything you want, anything. You can become an Alcoholics Anonymous. Number one, if it's legal. Number two, you're willing to work for it. And number three, that it doesn't hurt anybody else. You know, I'm not one of these guys that'll say you can do anything you want in Alcoholics Anonymous if you're willing to pay the price, because I know you don't know what that price is. And you don't know the price that everybody else is going to have to pay either. And that, you know, that's one of the misconceptions that I hear around. You know, but that's not the gift here. You know, the gift here is, and this one little thing, and I was going to share this real quick. I'm only going to read a sentence of it because I know I'm out of time. But it's kind of important. It was written by a great man named Nelson Mandela. And here was a guy who was in prison for a lot. And the thing I like about it, says, our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. Now, how many here are afraid of success? Yeah, me too, you know, and so it is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, or fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. You know, we are either all God's kids or none of us are. So the same rules apply to us all. If you're struggling with alcoholism tonight, give yourself a break. Give yourself a break. Go up to somebody here, and there's a lot of people here with time, and say, you know what, I need help. And make a commitment. Make a commitment, and you'll be able to stay one day at a time. You know, I don't know if Alcoholics Anonymous will ever open up the gates of heaven and let me in. But Alcoholics Anonymous opened up the gates of hell and let me out. You know, and it's rooms like this and people like you that allowed me to come in here and say me too for the first time in my life. And because of that, I was able to stay. And I will forever be indebted to you. Thank you very much.